Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble. I'd like to thank you for joining us as we delve into part two of our conversation with author John Cohasse about his book and friendship with Sonny Wilson, who played a major role in the rise and continuation of the affluent African-American summer resort and enclave, Idlewild. Well, that's what I like about your perspective from the book is it's coming right from Sonny. You know, this isn't... I hate to say, you know, that it's not some white man's perspective on the history of Idlewild. This is coming right from a man who was there during three or four different eras, major eras of the community.
Yeah, and he witnessed it. Yeah, and then he still went up there to relax and everything. He said anytime he would get a chance from Detroit, he would, you know, put the top down in the summer and get up there, you know, and he enjoyed his friend as they got older. But, yeah, it's just part of that whole, you know, all that nightclub and promotion stuff and everything. It's like boxing, you know. Bragg's, you know, promoted sports, so did Sonny, you know, boxing and all that. You know, Joe Louis, oh yeah, speaking of that, Sonny took Joe Louis up there, and Joe had heard about it, but he said, I don't want to go up to the woods, you know. I mean, he's from Alabama, he didn't want to go back to the woods. He said, what's up there? He says, man, you'll like it when you get there. So there's a picture in the book of Sonny with Joe Louis, and Joe Louis in the book is an interesting shot because he's got a t-shirt on and like chino pants, right? Go like a fisherman's hat, you know, and with Sonny, candid, just a shot. Well, they didn't let Joe be photographed casually like that. His promoters and everybody said, no, you know, Joe's got to have an image. And, you know, they never would have. That was a private picture that Sonny had never published. But, you know, Joe's up there, and he takes him up and takes him out in the boat in the lake, and Joe liked it. So he took Joe back. But the picture in the book's interesting is that there's a laid-back picture of Joe you just don't see because it was, you know, the publicity of it, you know, and the and his handlers, man, they didn't allow that kind of stuff. They didn't want Joe in a t-shirt, but it's cool, you know, picture. And Sonny had it in his big collection of odds and ends and pictures and stuff. So I'm glad it's in the book. But Joe, you know, went up there. There's another, you know, celebrity that went up there just to relax and have a good time. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting little enclave in, you know, the history of that whole region, you know. And thankfully, it existed and thrived for a while, and they're trying to get things going. When I was there, there wasn't a bar open yet, but a few years later, the Red Rooster opened, and it had some of my friends play blues there, and some jazz acts went up there. And then they had these, like, couple of festivals they were trying to, get going. I think COVID affected it. Red Rooster's gone, and there's a new owner, and it's called Peyton's. I have no idea. The bar is open now. You can Google it. So yeah, they're trying to get things.
Yeah, it looks like the whole area is going through a little bit of a renaissance. They're trying to kind of get it going back up and again. And I actually just heard like a week ago that they're doing a writer's retreat there. Oh, really? Yeah. So it looks like there's a little bit of. And then my friend Rick Wiles, who's a great historian here in town. He was telling me, I think there's like a small museum actually talking about the early days there. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of that old infrastructure is still there. I got to make a trip down there. You know, I'm an urban explorer. Yeah. I like seeing things like to go into that club before they renovate. It would be my dream. But it seems like it's having somewhat of a, of course, anything in Northern Michigan, whatever you consider Northern Michigan. But, you know, we're getting all these people coming up because of, we call them climate refugees. So everybody's coming back to Northern Michigan. Okay. And embracing all the cool, clean waters. And speaking of that, too, at this time, you know, when Idlewild was founded, there are other small clubs or small resort areas, but like one was near Brighton and Fenton, I think you mentioned. But of course, that's not like what I would consider
Branch
the northern.
Branch Brothers had a place in White Cloud, too. They were they dotted around there. You know, they mentioned other little spots. Sonny mentioned another little enclave, but I'm not familiar with it. I have to look back in the book. It was like, you know, probably a cluster of like rich black folks that bought some kind of land too. So, and you know, there's probably, you could have a whole book on resorts, you know, in Michigan, there'd be like a lot. you know, around. So, I don't know. I mean, it's pretty interesting because, you know, we're used to talking about, Little Traverse Bay and all that area. So, and it wasn't that far from the water, but yet, you know, being the time and place there, you know, that's what made the lake and Paradise. There's a Paradise Lake too. A couple lakes around there, Idlewild, because, you know, they could boat and do whatever and not be threatened by anything. So, you know, I mean, it'd be nice to go to Lake Michigan, but in the, you know, in segregation, it was nice to have that enclave and have, you know, the lakes right there.
Yeah, so you said it was a beautiful lake, right? And they had regattas yearly. I mean, they really utilized the terrain and the atmosphere of Northern Michigan.
Right, and I think it worked out for everybody. I mean, you know, the developers and stuff, and then the black boats that bought up all the land. You know, they made sure that the roads came in and that, and they had a post office, and you know, they had a roller rink. And I mean, some people had far off dreams that they wanted to build like a amusement park there, you know. So, but it never came about. But some say, well, if we would have done that, maybe people would have kept coming. But how would you know? You know. So it's that kind of thing where, you know, it could have worked, or when people went out all their other places. But you're saying is, you know, the interest of coming back now. You know, escaping the heat of whatever, and you know, so maybe things will change. But we, you know, I just encourage, you know, like you yourself, you know, like go and check it out. You know, go, you know, see what's there and patronize maybe you know the bar there and see what they have, and maybe the, you know, see. You know, just check it out, you know.
Yeah, it's on my short list for things to do this summer. I got to make it down there. I got to definitely make it down there.
Yeah, and, you know, I did too, because like I said, I haven't been there since, you know, the early 90s. But, you know, so I haven't seen it. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of it's happened since then, because like I said, not even the Red Rooster was open, that bar yet. That was still some years off. And I see they're having some festivals and stuff in the past. They COVID messed that up, but, you know, we'll see, you know. And, two books have been written since my book, and one was on, you know, Michigan State, press, and the other one's on U of M. It's even a lot, the U of M one's more current, and it's quite a study. You know, I still think, you know, you could do another book just on, you know, a small book about it. It's not in my wheelhouse, but just on the music itself. They have some really good chapters in there, but they could go back and find even more, because, you know, about, you know, Little Willie John and people like that, you know, just in more detail and more advertisements and stuff. So, you know, it would have been something to be up north, and then you could see Jackie Wilson. Like, if you lived around that area, it'd be a trip, man, you know, because that was stuff that, you know, you're up north where you're at, and that, you know, you didn't get that much of that stuff at that day and time. So you didn't have to drive all the way to Detroit to see it, right? Or right. Grand Rapids, or, you know, or wherever. I'm not an expert up at your end, you know, how far the theaters went with that stuff. I know Bay City. And,
well, we had up here, Rick Wiles does a thing over by where Michigan Maple Block, if people in the Northern Michigan are familiar with that, it's one of the oldest businesses in Michigan's now being... Right. It's almost completely, they've almost demolished the whole thing in the last 2 weeks. It's amazing. 1883, and within just a couple of weeks, it's gone. But right across the street from there used to be the Rainbow Club, and that was an African-American nightclub. And they brought up some pretty good performers, from what I understand. We'll have probably a future episode on the Rainbow Club. But we did get those performers coming up here even also. But, you know, the Idlewild went through so many similar transitions that same very reminiscent of what happened up here, you know, originally targeting kind of Chicago and the Midwest because the infrastructure is here from the lumbering boom. The first few years of operation at Idlewild, it kind of reminds me also of the fact of Bayview, Michigan, where before all the Victorian cottages came, pretty much just wood tents, they call them, on slabs. So in the early years of Idlewild, these are smaller places, right? And you even refer to the fact that when, and of course, they acquired up to what, like 36 square miles eventually?
filmed like that. And what they did too on the slab, they eventually built like what they call dog houses. That's their name for it. Little wooden structures on top of it, you know, at the very first. And then, you know, then you would go and buy a lot and build a cottage or whatever. Yeah. So.
And you even reference, you know,
pictures of those.
Yeah. And you reference also that's going to show the time, with, you know, the era we're talking about here. At one point, small little sections were available. People could buy small parcels. And I think you referred to them, and of course, this is the most derogatory term, but this is what was acceptable at the time, Negro patches, right? These are like referring back to small patches.
Well, no, there
of
was
land.
A section where one of them called it something patch. There was one of the big, you know, families that invested in it. They, what it generally was too, it's like, yeah, there were people, I don't know how many lots that the boys bought or whoever, but the first people, like the Wilsons, Lila and Herman Wilson, they bought a lot. They bought, you know, like multiple lots, and then built, like, you know, the first, you know, they built the first structures, really, and then the store, and they built a store and stuff. So it's like, you could buy as many as you want, but they had money, you know? So they bought up a lot and then developed it. So there's prominent people that bought up, you know, quite a big pieces of property, and then people that just bought some lots, you know, and like the boys never even built anything on it. He just invested in it and encouraged people to invest in it. Like in the Bleeding Back magazines, like even in the Crisis, he wrote a nice tribute in the Crisis magazine, you know, about Idlewild. And I think it's kind of interesting because increasingly, Du Bois became more and more, you know, militant in his fight. So this is, he wrote a nice little, I could read it to you if you want. I think this was about Idlewild and the Crisis. And this was one of his comments. He said, no one will accuse me of over partiality toward my paler neighbors. I deeply regret, as I grow older, a white face is to me a sign of inherent distrust and suspicion, which I have to fight in order to be just. Now, white men developed Idlewild. They recognized its beauty, bought it, and attracted colored people here. They have made money by the operation. That was their object. But they have not been hogs. They have not squeezed the lemon dry, and they apparently have been absolutely open, square, and just. Idlewild is worth every penny. It is worth a good deal more than most people paid for it. White men developed it because they knew how. We pay for their experience, and we pay a very low sum. Our hats are off to the Idlewild Resort Company. I think that says a lot from Du Bois, you know, who was, you know, a very powerful, you know, civil rights person of the 20th century. And wrote a really, you know, landmark book, Souls of Black Folks, that I read while I was studying history in college. So, and yeah, that's a good tribute.
And yeah, it was amazing, actually, especially for that, you know, that time we're talking about here. You mentioned something, too. Was there a sister or a neighboring community where people were coming back and forth also that was in close proximity? I lost my note here on the name of that establishment.
No, I mean, Sonny talked about some little tiny place, but it was just very, very small and very elite. So I don't, and nothing like that people would know. I'm not that expert in it. I think that, you know, there are two books that came out. The first one was Black Eden, which was a nickname for the Idlewild.
Yeah, so you call it the Black Eden, the Apollo of the North, even the Black Las Vegas.
Yeah, Black Eden. Yeah, the Black. Yeah, that. Those were, yeah, nicknames. And so this book, Black Eden, the Idlewild Community, the Michigan State University Press, then followed by a much more extensive book, Idlewild, The Rise, Decline, and Rebirth of a Unique African-American Resort Town. And that's University of Michigan Press. And I looked through there, and, you know, and I read, I was, you're going back over this stuff and looking at it. I didn't get any, you know, really sense that there was another place equal to that. There might have been some land that they bought, but not that I know of to the answer to that question. And but anyway, I was I come into this because I wrote about T-Bone Walker in the Idlewild Review. I'm not expert at the whole history, the whole environment. I just coming in from Sonny's experience in it and the background, and I got these books, so I was, you know, now check these sources out, which is good that they came out. They're good to, you know, have reference material about it. But it's like I was looking at it, and I think that it'd be a nice smaller book for somebody to like really line up who really played there and what date and try to, you know, nail it down, because they advertised, you know, a lot, like the Review and a lot of papers, and like the Michigan Chronicle. I have some ads that here I'm looking at, the Black Paper of Detroit, but always listed the Ottawa Review until its demise. So, and then they'd have articles about it, you know, and so other Black papers, you know, you could find out where they were playing and what, you know, what the reviews were when they were playing those other cities and stuff. So the music is still, you know, a little bit. I question some of the people that they say play there. I just went like, I've seen the name, but it happens like that. You know, it's like in Detroit, there's, you know, certain venues, and they say Jimi Hendrix played there. Well, he didn't. So,
well, we saw the viral picture of Hendrix on Mackinac Island, right? Remember that picture?
Wasn't that one good?
That was great.
Boy, that was great. And, you know, I just, like, for a split second believed it. And then I went, like, to my friend, you better check this one. And I liked it. What was the name of the festival on the island?
I can't remember.
Island Jazz Festival.
Yeah, Mackinac Island Jazz Festival. And I bought into it. I bought into it.
Yeah. Did you?
Yeah.
Well, what's funny is because we would have known that there was a jazz festival on Mackinac Island. It was like, it seems too hip for the fudge people.
But you know what's funny though, as we discussed in a couple episodes back, we're still dealing with the club Manitou and the ponytail here. But one of the last acts that played here in Harbor Springs was Sly and the Family Stone. If you can imagine them walking around in the '60s downtown Harbor Springs, dressed in all their funkadelic regalia, you know, the clothes and so.
My God.
That picture of Hendrix wasn't so surprising to me. I thought, well, you know, we had Manitou and Ponytail here. We were bringing these
right.
Acts
well,
up.
I guess I don't know where that ship where they were, you know, standing next to it's, probably was
so photoshopped.
Could have been anywhere. Yeah, could have been anywhere.
Right,
but
Iowa,
photoshopped.
Right.
What did we say? What did we say? And you know, but your point is, I think we wanted it to be true for a second because it was like, wow, that's pretty trippy.
That'd be so cool to think Hendrix was at the fort. You know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so it's, you know, it's just one of those things. And, you know, so it's the history of it. And I'm probably, you know, we're probably talking, you know, on and on about the stuff with getting away from our subject. But, you know, it's one of those things I enjoyed writing about and going up there and, you know, and
one thing I got to ask you
after about it.
Yeah, and one thing I got to ask you about, too, is there's other things that pop up during this. Sonny talks about different places he had visited prior. The one thing that just jumped out at me, you have a little section in your book. It talks about the Octagon Castle. He shows up at this
now
resort.
That's an odd one. Did you ever hear about that?
No, and one just really grabbed me when I was reading. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Well, I don't, because that's all he ever said. Sonny was really good about talking about people, about their behavior, what they look like, what clothes they wore, how they show. About places, he always went, Sonny, what it looked like. It was beautiful. He wasn't interested in getting into detail about, like, what a place looked like. Like, it had a long hallway, and it was next to, he just, you know, I always would get like frustrated sometimes because I wanted more description, you know. So that what you read is all I know.
And he describes
anything more about it, I don't know.
Yeah, he really doesn't. For the listener, he talks about Octagon Castle, someplace that's kind of got like a German resort, and there's these Germans talking back and forth to the homeland via radios, you know, shortwave radios, and. It kind of freaked him out, is what you said in the book. He's surrounded by.
Yeah, I mean, it was like I just went and shook my head and went, that sounds really weird, you know.
That sounds really strange.
Yeah, so anybody knows about that, they can kind of like relate, because I had so much stuff to look up, And even Idlewild itself, I knew nothing about. So I had to, you know, do enough to write those, you know, like preparatory historical little sketches, you know, intros for the chapters. So to me, it was like, it was another strange thing. But after I did the whole book and I had to read about Joe Louis and boxing and this and that, and, you know, it was like Hastings Street itself and all those places and all those people, it was like those little detail things, you know, still like you go back and go, that was, I don't know. it was overwhelming just to put that book, which isn't very lengthy, you know, but we spent 3 or 4 years between all the interviewing and, you know, he didn't write anything. It was all done by tapes, you know, and mm-hmm. my notes. He never handed me any written sentence typed or anything, you know, so that wasn't the point, you know. But the point is, when you do stuff like that, you have to go back and do as much background as you can. Because one time I asked him, Sonny, was that before the war? He says, what war? I lived through so many of them. You know, and he would say things like, I'm not sure. But then I go by the black newspaper too and see the event with the time. He had a lot of ads that his clubs were in there. And even back when he was working for gangsters, he worked for the Purple Gang back in the old days, you know, and it was a front for their operation. So I would look it up in the paper, find the exact address, you know, and look at the ads and stuff, you know, and it took time. You know, it's like you can go through these. I read a lot of memoirs, you know, that are written in with or and. I was a with, which makes it a weaker than an and. An and is an equal, so you're a co-author. Really, I'm a with, gives me credit that I assisted in the book. So I wanted to make sure as a historian, I just wanted, got so curious. You would be too, you know, like, where was this place exactly on the corner? His mind was really good, but sometimes, you know, the date of the year, you know, like when he's talking about watching Joe Louis, you know, in the heavyweight title winning it. I mean, I had to go back. Was it a right or left, you know? And, you know, when he knocked out Braddock, you know, it was like, see, he had to do those kind of things. You know, I read the account of the fight, but I wanted to know, see, that's, and so the more work you do, the more accurate you try to be, you know, the better the book will be, and it'll be more relevant historically. I see a lot of sloppy stuff sometimes, you know, but people rush through things, and the person that's speaking, remember, he was old, very old by then, and mm-hmm. he's talking about stuff that went back decades and decades and decades, you know, but he had a good memory. But again, physical descriptions of places were weren't his forte. So the Octagon weird thing, if you ever find it, or anybody.
That's on my list.
I have no idea. No, I don't.
We got to find out more about that one.
Go ahead.
Well, one thing for me is it's a little bit of irony that, you know, the 60s, when the resort, a lot of things are going on. Of course, you have the civil rights movement. You have auto workers now that have time off. So what could have been kind of like, it started out as for the elites, and all of a sudden now everybody's kind of coming up, and it could have just exploded, you know, as far as population. But that's almost the beginning of the end,
right?
In the 60s, which again, you talk about like this, the connection to Motown a little bit. One of the Motown musical directors is got a place there. They're bringing acts up. Barry Gordy was famous for making sure his performers had dancing experience and choreography and etiquette, mm-hmm. and all that. But you say some of the Motown acts are coming up to kind of cut their chops up there also in the early 60s?
Yeah, the Four Tops. Four Tops were started out as the Four Ames, AIMS, not the Ames Brothers. In fact, a lot of sources spell it as the Ames. Right? The reason they changed it was they didn't want Ames in it. It wasn't that great of a name. By the way, so when I thought it might have been Gordy, but they signed in 56 with Chess Records down in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We're used to blues and Chuck Berry's great label. And became the Horned Tops, because I kind of had to look it up, because in the sources, they're not music people. So I'm thinking, like, why is it the Four Ames? And all of a sudden, the Art of Wild Review in 61 or 2 have them as the Four Tops. Well, the name was changed, you know, in 56, I believe, when they started. And then Gordy picked them up quickly and put them to, you know, super fame. So, yeah, they were the main people that were, I don't know of anybody else. There was, you know, they were the main ones that they got. I didn't read about anybody, any of the other acts. And they were up there before Gordy. This is pre-Gordy, you know, there's no Gordy at all. Mm-hmm. Bragg's was booking them as, you know, before Ames. And then they had the time in 56, and I don't have any in front of me when they signed with Motown, but, you know, it was, they were there when they were not long out of high school, you know, when they first went up there. And, but there were people that had big, tight connections to Detroit. If, you know, they weren't Detroiters, but they were up there. But no, that was pretty much, no Motown people were there, because by the time they hit Motown, they were mega. They're not going to play there. You know, Gordy's going to put him in big, giant theater. That was another thing, too. Young folks didn't want, I would say, if you're a 20-some-year-old and you're, like some of my black friends, they would go to the Fox and see like six bands, you know, and they'd come on. And like we said, the dancing show became the singers themselves. You know, there were going to be show people coming out. No disrespect, but that's old time. It goes back to the 30s, you know, and old review shows. It was dated by that. And one thing about African-American music and like any other music, you know, that was happening, change happens. It was happening fast, right? I mean, you demanded new. T-Bone Walker, to me, I'd love to see T-Bone Walker, but not 20-some-year-olds. They want to hear James Brown and, you know, and rhythm and blues and funk and souls coming, right, by the mid-60s. So the taste changed, you know, and I would put it to the music, too, you know, because great people on those shows, but young people didn't want to see nightclub acts, you know, and comedians and stuff like that in their show. They wanted the boom bang, you know, Jackie Wilson come out and then blah, blah, blah. Like my friend saw James Brown at Fox, and there was like five different groups, you know, and then he headlined, and it was just one bang after another, you know. So they didn't have that old review style thing was already dated, you know. Music was changing as well, so.
And Idlewild had to change with the times. They had to change with the times, and unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, and like one of the articles said, when Sonny's friend, you know, Ziggy Johnson, the choreographer and dance instructor, said they're bringing, you know, they're repopularizing the review show up there, you know, and it was great for summer entertainment. You know, you enjoyed the whole package in the show, and you're sitting down eating, and that's nightclub stuff. Now, when you go to nightclub, you're talking about going to theaters to see, you know, R&B groups, and you want to dance in the aisle. You don't even want to get out of your seat, you know. It's not a nightclub situation. You know, nightclubs music would survive, but that would be like jazz became very, you know, developed into a high art form. You didn't go to the jazz club to hear Miles Davis and dance.
No.
You sat there, you know, and you listened to sets of genius, you know, high art music, you know, and that was a different scene. Not popular music so much, but that was a whole different, it wasn't a review show.
No.
You know, no. So when you had the greats like, you know, Miles and Coltrane coming and all those guys and those black clubs, those were a completely different thing. The Drome and all that. Detroit, no. It's not. And no disrespect, but Sonny came out of that time period, you know, singing and dancing and you know, MC and stuff. And it was just another whole, you know, era. It was like, you know, like people love variety shows and they died, you know, after a while, you know, singing and dancing, comedian and, you know, Ed Sullivan and blah, blah, blah. And then comes, you know, James Brown for, you know, and Jackie Wilson and the Beatles for the kid, you know what I mean? And they want to go to a show. And it's a whole different thing. Pack them in the big auditoriums, you know, and it's going to grow and be huge, you know? And so times changed fast. best at that mid part of the 60s, as we know.
Well, yeah, and over the whole course, I think, you know, Idlewild is a perfect example of the transition of music and entertainment. Not just African American lifestyle, but
in general. Yeah,
in general,
absolutely. Because so you know, I mean, that's what I'm saying is, and soul and funk is coming. You know, like live, you know, it's coming down the pike, man. It's like so, it. And I love it all. I mean, I love T-Bone Walker's music, you know, and hopefully he can work some of it into the show, you know, and stuff like that. And Jackie Wilson is just a tremendous, you know, performer. But he made that great leap from, you know, into, you know, crossover stuff and you know, that modern R&B. So he wasn't that dated, you know, that kind of thing. He was there as a transitional person. But, but a lot of the music in those old dance bands that played like jump blues and, you know, sophisticated kind of backing for the comedians and stuff, they weren't going to find any employment anymore. Unless, you know what I mean? It was like, it was headed towards the whole Motown. Look at that, you know, I mean, that sound and everything else. So, yeah, it was also in a musical transitional period, you know, as far as history goes, too.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the next incarnation of Idlewild, you know, looks like here in a few years as far as it's, you know.
Well, you're seeing more and more people probably come, you know, in your region. I don't know, you know, the summer, you're talking about people going back up north again. I forgot the term you were using, escape the heat type.
Yeah, people. We call them climate refugees, and we were just over on the East Coast the other day. You know, Sheboygan used to be such a sleepy little town over there, and now everything's being inundated over there, too. It's going to be just a matter of time before, I mean, you're going to have the same thing going on the East Coast as the West Coast now. You got the mega cottages going up, and the towns are getting populated, and that's going to happen all up and down the coast here, in my opinion, as people keep kind of moving towards the what we are known for, cool, fresh air, fresh waters.
Right. And starting all desirable. Over again. Remember the ads for, you know, for Toski about escaping the heat and the hay fever and everything else and the clear air. It's like you're right back to those ads that were drawing people north, you know, that were there around the turn of the century, you know.
History repeats itself every time.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it up there, and I enjoyed the UP, you know. It was great.
Where'd you guys go?
Marquette.
Yeah, it's my little guy's favorite town. I love Marquette's
great. And St. Ignace, the first night, and then Marquette, you know, because we have, family people there, so they all were up there.
Well, you know,
Hendrix, some locals.
Hendrix played in St. Ignace, too, on his way back from the island. They went to the main. I'm just teasing.
Well, okay, then. I'm just saying. Well, I know this is, you know, we could talk and go off the subject, but I enjoyed that. Took a picture of that courthouse where, you know, an Anatomy of Murder.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on Anatomy of a Murder, and actually the Volker family lives
here
in Petoskey.
I'll have to listen to that. Okay, cool.
Here's a little bit of trivia for you too. And I got to search this out to make sure the documentation's correct. But at the Little Traverse History Museum now, they have the piano. They swear to God it was Grace Hemingway's mother's, and it winds up in the Volker family because they're from somewhere near Oak Park. They had connections, and somehow or another, she gives the piano to the Volker family, and it wound up back here in Petoskey. And it's said that was actually the piano that was in the bar up there, and or the resort, one of the two. So I got to follow up on this just to make sure it's actually there's some truth to that story.
That's a Chris thing. You can definitely find that little piece of history. That's great. Anyway, I mean, we're blabbing on and on, and whoever's recording is probably saying, "Well, this is all going to get erased."
No. We're going for it. We're going for a full hour. So like the last thing I'll ask you. Where can people find your works? Do you still have your online bookstore? Because I mean, you've written so many of these.
It's a Shopify. There's a Shopify store, and it's Seven Arts Books. You know, it's just .com. You know, www.sevenartsbooks.com. And it showcases everything that I have for sale, including the the Hemingway booklets that you use on your tours.
Yeah, our original interview that we did for a publication, that wound up being the definitive summary, really, in my opinion, of Hemingway's time here in northern Michigan.
The shortest little introductory there is, but hey, we needed something like, you know, we agreed when we first met, something accurate that we, you know, that you could, you know, just introduce the basic facts and background. And so that's on there, you know, Hemingway's Last Good Country. There's small, you know, little booklets like that all the way to all the published stuff. So, yeah, and I did, you know, there's books about Hemingway, and I just got back from London. So the Hemingway Pound book that I wrote, I went and found Pound, one of Pound's first apartments in London. And so I still like youth research, you know, stuff that I, oh, here I'm over here, you know, I can take a picture for the book. So yeah, all those books are in there. Sonny Wilson, the life, you know, Tulsa the Town, the Life of Times of Sonny Wilson is on my site. And the enticement to go to the site is that I sell the books a little cheaper than you get them online or from the publisher. So I always tell people, you want to save a couple dollars, you can buy them from me, or you can go to Wayne State Press's site and buy the Sonny Wilson book there.
And such a wide, such a wide variety too of you know, things you've touched upon in these books that you've written. Just so, such a wide variety of history.
Yeah, topics from the Civil War to, like, you know, mostly American though, and mostly cultural. In this stuff, like, you know, it's the music stuff that I read and that I have written, and then there's like articles on there. Like I did one article about that you can read about Jimi Hendrix's, you know, inspiration for the weird tunes he wrote, you know, about his lyrics rather than his guitar playing. So I enjoyed that essay, writing it, because like the great Gil Evans said that, you know, conducted instrumental stuff of his work, Gil had worked with Miles, is that we forget Hendrix wrote some pretty interesting tunes. And that's why he said we forget that on the guitar play. So I wrote an essay that's on there about, you know, what inspired Hendrix's, you know, very unique lyric. So we have to go into that. But there's like things on there you can go read, and stuff about Hemingway, you know, that is kind of, you know, the Civil War and Hemingway's imagination. There's a big essay about that influenced, and how remember the banning of Hemingway's To Have and Have Not, Detroit? I was the first one to write about that. That short essay's on there. So that, a lot of it's still in Michigan. That one has to do with, you know, Detroit during the 30s and the reception of Hemingway's novel at the time. And people will remember that novel was made into The Have and Have Not, the movie. So anyway, yeah, there's the bookstore features everything too. It's kind of like a, you know, it serves as both, you know, an introductory to a lot of the essays that I wrote that I already published, so I can keep on and read it. But everything else from something from, you know, small, you know, published essays to the book. So, yeah, that's where you can go. Seven Art Books. So that's kind of my showcase.
Well, I can't thank you enough, John, for sharing all this information. I really encourage our listeners to go back and check out your site and find some other topics that may be of interest to them. And maybe we'll have you back on to talk about some of those. We try to do at least one Hemingway a year. Of course, you're as well-versed in Hemingway as I am. But just all these different niche things, like you mentioned, the band in Detroit might be very interesting to people that have no necessarily interest in Hemingway, but it's the politics that were going on at the time. And that's a...
Yeah, and I try to choose things that haven't been done like over and over again, too. It's just another little insight into the thing. But like when we first met, we talked about Hemingway. He came to the jewelry store, and you were like, and then we ended up talking like, I don't know how many hours.
It was hours.
Daughter and my wife went off and shopped. But what did we end up after that? Were we on after Hemingway? No. Then we went to music. Well, you play? Okay. Then so this is kind of like that. We're back to like, you know, Hemingway and music again. So it was fun talking about, you know, all the acts up there, and many of them I really do like. I mean, a lot of I mentioned are You know, I've got albums and CDs by Dinah Washington and T-Bone Walker and all those people. And Jackie Wilson, I've got 45s over here. So it was fun talking about, you know, the music that you know, some of the music that I really like and I've always liked. So I enjoyed talking about that, and I'm happy that you had me on.
Hey, special thanks to John Cohasse, our guest today on Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I've been your host, Christopher Struble, and we look forward to you joining us in future episodes. And again, as always, if there's a special topic of interest that you would like to hear more about, or if you are an expert in any of these areas of American history, especially Northwestern Michigan specifically, but anything to do with Michigan, we'd love to hear your thoughts and possibly have you on as a guest.